I was standing in the kitchenette of the 44th floor, watching the milk swirl into my coffee, when the realization finally hit the floor and shattered. It wasn't a loud realization. It didn't sound like a glass breaking or a door slamming. It sounded like a heavy, expensive silence. The kind of silence that only exists in wood-paneled corner offices, where decisions are made about people who aren't in the room. I had been a director of operations for 7 years. I had been with the firm for 15. I knew the rhythmic hum of the HVAC system, the specific scent of the industrial carpet cleaner, and the exact tone of voice my boss Marcus used when he was about to lie to me. I checked my watch. It was 7:15 a.m. I was always the first one in, a habit I'd formed back when I thought that being the first to arrive and the last to leave was a quantifiable metric of worth. I walked back to my desk, my heels clicking against the marble transition, and saw the folder Marcus had left for me. It was the quarterly projection for the mid-market equity fund. He'd left a sticky note on top that said, "Give this the magic touch. We need it for the 10 a.m. The magic touch was code. It meant I needed to fix his math, clarify his vague strategy, and make it look like he had spent his weekend working instead of golfing in Scottsdale. I sat down and opened my laptop, but my eyes kept drifting to the bottom drawer of my desk. Inside, tucked under a stack of old performance reviews and a spare pair of tights, was a printout I shouldn't have had. It was a spreadsheet I'd found on the shared drive 3 nights ago, buried in a folder titled Furniture Inventory 2024. It wasn't about desks or chairs. It was a list of every director and senior VP in the division. There were columns for technical proficiency, client retention, and then a final column that simply said L factor. Next to my name, under technical proficiency, it said 10. Under client retention, it said 10. Under L factor, it said 12. I had spent 48 hours trying to figure out what L stood for. Leadership, legacy, leverage. Then I saw the entry for a guy named Miller, a senior VP who had been promoted over me twice despite the fact that I'd had to explain basic compound interest to him during a lunch meeting. His technical score was a 4. His L factor was a 2. The L stood for loyalty. Or more accurately, the L stood for liability. A high L factor didn't mean you were a leader. It meant you were a load bearer. I was a 12 because I was the person holding up the roof. If you move a load bearer, the whole structure starts to creak. The air in the office always felt a little thinner on the executive floor, like they were pumping in a specialized blend of nitrogen and ego. I started working on Marcus's projections. I moved the decimals, tightened the narrative, and smoothed over the gaps in his logic. I did it with the mechanical efficiency of a surgeon. I had done this for him when he was a director, then when he was a managing director, and now as he sat in the VP chair. I had been his secret weapon for a decade. He told me that at every Christmas party, he told me that every time I asked about the empty senior VP seat, "You're too valuable here, Sarah. You're the engine. I can't fly the plane if the engine moves to the cockpit." He thought it was a compliment. He thought that by calling me an engine, he was acknowledging my power. What he was actually doing was telling me I was a part, not a person. You don't promote an engine. You maintain it. You oil it. You keep it in the dark where it can do the heavy lifting without ruining the view from the window. Around 9:30 a.m., the office began to wake up. The sound of elevator chimes and the low murmur of the old boys' club began to filter through the glass partitions. I watched them pass my office, men in tailored navy suits who all seemed to have the same haircut and the same way of laughing. They moved in a pack, a slow-moving tide of confidence that didn't require results to sustain itself. They had something I didn't, the freedom to be mediocre. I looked at the spreadsheet again. Miller's L factor was a 2, because he was replaceable. He could be moved, promoted, or fired, and the work would still get done, because someone like me was doing it. My competence wasn't a ladder, it was a cage. I was the person who knew where the bodies were buried, because I was the one who had to dig the graves and file the paperwork afterward. The sensory shift happened when Marcus walked into my office. He smelled of expensive cedarwood and the peppermint he chewed to hide the fact that he'd had a scotch at 11 p.m. the night before. He leaned against my doorframe, the fabric of his suit bunching at the shoulders. "You got that magic for me?" he asked. He didn't sit down. He never sat in my office. Standing kept him in a position of transit, a man on the move, while I was the stationary resource. "It's on your desk," I said. I kept my voice flat, professional, restrained. "You're a lifesaver," he said, pointing a finger at me like a gun. "Listen, about the board meeting next month, I'm going to need you to prep the briefing books. I know it's a lot of grunt work, but I only trust your eyes on this. We'll talk about that title change after the fiscal year closes. I promise. We just need to get through this hurdle first." I'd heard that sentence for 3 fiscal years. The hurdle was a moving target. It was a horizon line that receded every time I took a step toward it. I looked at the way his cufflink, a silver knot, caught the fluorescent light. It was a small, sharp glint of wealth. "The fiscal year," I repeated. "Right. Glad we're on the same page," he said, already turning to leave. I waited until he was gone, and then I pulled the spreadsheet back up. I looked at the L factor column. I looked at my 12. I realized that my loyalty wasn't being rewarded. It was being harvested. I was a crop. I was being farmed for my labor, and as long as I kept producing a high yield, there was no reason for them to change the arrangement. Why would Marcus ever promote me? If he promoted me, he'd have to do his own math. He'd have to write his own strategy. He'd have to actually know what was in the funds he was selling. I felt a coldness settle in my chest, a physical sensation like drinking ice water on a winter day. I opened a new tab on my browser. I didn't look at the market. I didn't look at the internal news. I looked at the private client list I had built over 15 years. I knew these people. I knew their kids' names. I knew which ones were worried about their legacy and which ones were just trying to outrun their own mortality. I had been the one answering their calls at 8 p.m. on a Friday, when Marcus was at a steakhouse. I was the one who explained the tax implications of their divestments. To them, I wasn't an engine. I was the person who kept their world from falling apart. At noon, I went down to the lobby. The Chicago wind was whipping off the lake, a biting, relentless force that made people duck their heads and hurry inside. I stood on the sidewalk for a moment, letting the cold hit my face. Across the street, there was a small, high-end coffee shop where I often met clients. I saw one of our biggest accounts, a man named Arthur, who had $300 million with the firm, sitting by the window. He looked tired. He was 72, and he didn't trust the new guys Marcus kept trying to transition him to. I went back up to the 44th floor. The carpet felt softer, more suffocating. I realized then that I had been protecting something that didn't belong to me. I had been protecting the firm's reputation, Marcus's career, and the general illusion that the people at the top were there because they were the best. I was the silent architect of their success, and I was exhausted. I went to the printer room. It was a neutral space, a place where people stood and waited for machines to finish their cycles. I watched the paper slide out of the tray, warm, crisp, and covered in data. I was printing out my own inventory, not furniture, not L factors. I was printing out the service agreements I had drafted, the ones with the tiny overlooked clauses about non-compete durations and client solicitation. I had written them myself 5 years ago. I knew where the loopholes were because I had left them there, a subconscious insurance policy I hadn't realized I'd need. I walked past Miller's office. He was laughing, his feet up on his desk, talking to someone on his headset about a tea time. He looked so relaxed. He didn't have a 12 next to his name. He didn't have the burden of being essential. I felt a surge of something that wasn't quite anger. It was closer to clarity. I had been playing a game where the rules were designed to keep me in the starting blocks. I went back to my desk and looked at a photo of myself from 10 years ago. I was at my desk, smiling, holding a top performer award. I looked so eager. I looked like I believed that the meritocracy was a real thing, like a law of physics. I wanted to reach through the glass and tell that woman to stop, to tell her that every time she went above and beyond, she was just adding another bar to the cage. By 3 p.m., the 10 a.m. meeting that Marcus had crushed with my work was over. He came back into the office, beaming. He didn't come to my desk to thank me. He went straight to the senior VP's office, and I heard the muffled sound of their laughter through the wall. They were celebrating a victory I had won for them. I looked at the spreadsheet one last time. I found the column for retirement track. Next to my name, it was blank. For the men, there were dates. 2032, 2035. They had a map. I had a treadmill. I opened my personal email. I had a draft waiting there. It was a business plan I'd been tinkering with for 2 years, something I called the Operations Group. It was a consultancy designed to do exactly what I did now, but for the clients directly, cutting out the middleman in the Navy suit who couldn't do long division. I looked at the numbers. If I took just 3 of my top clients, I would make double my current salary in the first year. If I took 10, I could retire in 5 years. I felt a sudden, sharp memory of my mother. She had worked in a bank, too. A different era, a different city, but the same story. She used to come home with her feet aching from standing in high heels all day, smelling of old paper and desperation. She told me to get an education so I wouldn't have to take orders from men who were slower than me. I had the education, I had the experience, and yet here I was, fixing Marcus's math and waiting for a title that was never going to come. The shame of it wasn't that I was being held back. The shame was that I had allowed them to convince me that my value was tied to my silence. I had been proud of being the power behind the throne. I had worn my invisibility like a badge of honor. I realize now that being the power behind the throne just means you're the one who has to clean the floor when the king makes a mess. I looked at my phone. I had a text from a client, a woman who ran a massive logistics firm. Marcus is giving me the runaround on the fee structure. Can you call me? I need the real answer. I didn't forward the text to Marcus. I didn't ask for permission. I stood up, walked to the window, and looked out at the city. The sun was starting to set, casting long orange shadows across the skyscrapers. It looked like a forest of glass and steel, a place where things were built to last, but also a place that could be dismantled brick by brick if you knew where the structural weaknesses were. I knew exactly where the weaknesses were. I had spent 15 years studying the cracks. I went back to my desk and picked up the phone. I didn't call the client back. Not yet. Instead, I called a commercial real estate agent I knew. I need a small space, I said. My voice sounded different to my own ears. It was lower, steadier. Something with a view, but not on the executive floor. I'm moving. Moving firms? The agent asked. No, I said. I'm starting one. I hung up and looked at the door to Marcus's office. I could see his silhouette through the frosted glass. He was gesturing wildly, probably telling another story, where he was the hero. He had no idea that the engine had just detached itself from the plane. He had no idea that without my magic touch, his next quarterly projection was going to look like a disaster. I began to pack my things, not the official things, not the stapler or the company-issued laptop. I packed the personal things. The spare tights, the photo of my mother, the notebook where I'd kept track of every client's preference, every missed deadline by the VPs, and every L factor I'd observed over the years. I felt a strange sense of lightness, like I was shedding a skin that had grown too tight. I wasn't angry anymore. I was focused. I realized that the trap wasn't the job itself. The trap was the belief that they would eventually see me. They did see me. They saw me perfectly. They saw exactly how much they could take from me before I broke, and they had been carefully managing that threshold for years. I walked out of the office at 5:30 p.m. For the first time in 15 years, I didn't check the inbox on my way out. I didn't look at the lights to see who was still working. I just pressed the button for the lobby. As the elevator descended, I felt the pressure change in my ears. It was the same sensation as a plane taking off. By the time I hit the ground floor, I was already gone. I walked out into the Chicago evening. The wind was still there, but it didn't feel like a threat anymore. It felt like momentum. I pulled out my phone and called the logistics client back. "Hey, it's Sarah," I said. "I'm leaving the firm. I'm opening my own shop on Monday. If you want the real answer about those fees and a team that actually knows how to manage your capital, I think we should have coffee tomorrow morning. Not at the office, somewhere new." There was a pause on the other end of the line. I held my breath, the cold air stinging my lungs. "Sarah," the client said, and I could hear the smile in her voice. "I've been wondering when you were going to say that. Send me the address. I'll be there." I ended the call and kept walking. I didn't look back at the high rise. I didn't need to. I knew exactly what was happening on the 44th floor. Marcus was probably looking for his coffee, or his next projection, or the woman who made him look like a genius. He was going to keep looking for a long time. I had been a 12 on the L factor scale. I had been the ultimate load bearer. But the thing about load bearers is that when they move, they don't just leave a hole, they change the entire landscape. I walked toward the train, my heels steady on the pavement. I had 15 years of data, a list of clients who trusted me, and a loophole in a contract that I had written myself. I wasn't a director anymore. I wasn't an engine. I was the person who was about to take the whole machine apart and build something better with the pieces. The city felt wide open. The trap had finally sprung, but I wasn't the one caught in it. I was the one who had walked away while the jaws were still snapping shut on the air I'd left behind. I thought about the spreadsheet one last time. I wondered who they would try to put in my seat. I wondered if she would be another woman in her late 30s, someone who was too valuable to promote. I hoped she'd find the file. I hoped she'd see her own L factor and realize what it meant before she wasted another decade holding up a roof that was never meant to cover her. But that wasn't my problem anymore. My legacy wasn't going to be a title on a frosted glass door or a 401k managed by men who didn't know my name. My legacy was going to be the clients I took, the firm I built, and the silence I finally broke. I stepped onto the train and watched the doors close. The reflection in the glass was a woman I recognized, but she looked different. She looked like someone who had stopped waiting for a seat at the table and had decided to build her own room. The train pulled out of the station, heading away from the high rise and into the dark.